It's Spoiler in Time, folks, a Cord Killers production, but unlike Cord Killers, where we talk about the things we can watch and how to watch them, here, we've already watched them, and we spoil the loving crap out of them. This week, we're going to talk about The Office UK, which we're rewatching, episode 2 of season 1, True Detective, episodes 6 and 7 of season 3, and the movie Captain Marvel. I'm Tom Merritt, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. But most importantly, we have to start things off by, I suppose, checking in on the summer movie draft.
First of all, Brian, my compliments to the chef at draft.diamondclub.tv.
Oh my gosh, doesn't it look great?
This is a beautiful new website that T2T2 has put together.
Yeah, dude, it's fantastic. What's funny is like I'm old fashioned, so it's like I go to the charts. Is there a way to arrange everything in chronological order? I mean, this is it's so beautiful that immediately I want to know
movies.
What else can it do? Oh, you
go
click
to
on movies.
Diamondclub.tv, click on the word movies.
Oh, there
the
it
top.
Is. Oh, this Boom. Is great. Oh, my goodness. This is amazing. And, of course, the Chat Realm League. Oh, this is great. Right now, it's a 216-way tie.
In the Chat Realm League.
Yeah.
You're in first, everyone who's playing.
No, everybody who got Captain Marvel
everybody
specifically.
Who got Captain
yeah.
Marvel. Everybody who took Captain Marvel, yeah. Exactly. Well, and that's a good point. Nothing was in the movie draft last week to go up against Captain Marvel. So Captain Marvel is the only movie with any money at $264,884,000. That's a chump change.
Not too shabby.
That's a pretty good buy for the old team drawn tracker there.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I guess they got Toy Story 4 and It Chapter 2. I think they're looking at what? Maybe 750, 800 million total?
Yeah. We'll see how much the Captain Marvel train continues, because we do have some movies coming out this week, although neither one of them really are going to threaten Captain Marvel particularly. Hotel Mumbai, which is Team Hammerson's game, movie, comes out, and Us, which is Team Beerist's, it's Grant's movie, is coming out. But those are not expected to do $100 million, $200 million. Well, Dumbo is probably the next big one. That's your movie that's coming out in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Something tells me Dumbo, those Disney people, they know how to make a little bit of cash.
They do. Whether that will that steal from themselves with Captain Marvel? Well, I don't know.
To maybe. Be honest, I perceive that Captain Marvel, its biggest challenge, and I probably should have looked this up to begin with, is to whether or not it would maintain its week over week dominance.
It did the first 2 weeks.
Yeah. So that's a good question.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to finally get back on my wife's preview train. I'm going to go see Us tomorrow night. Apparently it is incredibly scary. So
yeah.
I'll let you know next week what I think.
Trailer alone was scary.
Yeah. So that's where we are with the movie draft. Let's talk about aforementioned Captain Marvel, which has plenty of people who love it, plenty of people spending lots of money on it. Brian and I got to see it together last week when I was in Austin, Texas. I liked it more than you, but neither one of us loved it.
Yeah. Okay. Things that I think make a good movie. Plots. Characters who develop, likable, jokes. Those are good. Also, references are not jokes. Stating things that happened in the 90s is not a joke. Look, it was really tough. It was like sitting down on the couch next to somebody playing a video game and you're like, oh my God, I heard great things about this video game. And they're like, yeah. And then you see them typing in the console commands. You're like, what are you doing? And you're like, unlocking God mode. And you're like, what does that do? He's like, makes me so my character is super powerful, has nothing to worry about. Also, the universe has no consequences whatsoever. And at no point do you feel threatened. And you're like, well, does that make it a better game? They're like, no, but it makes me feel really good playing it. Like, but you're playing it, I'm watching it. And they're like, well, too bad for you, Brian.
I mean, the problem with talking about Captain Marvel is it's become such a football for other things, that if you don't like it in a way that's different than the way somebody liked it, now you hate them. And that's not fair. Brian didn't find it funny. Maybe you found it funny. I've found a couple of things funny, you know, here and there. I also felt like you didn't have as much of a character arc as I would have liked. That you just did. You just didn't see her have the challenge that she needed to really feel like I would stand up and cheer for her. And I liked her. I wanted to stand up and cheer for her, but I just never felt that the moments they gave us that were supposed to be, okay, here she is prevailing against the odds, were those moments that really like caused me to feel like the tension had built up sufficiently that she would overcome them. That said, the storyline about the fact that she had been taught to suppress her emotions and had to come to realize that she didn't necessarily need to do that. She could trust herself. I think that played very differently depending on who you were. I'll just be honest. It didn't play as well as I think it could have for me, but your mileage may vary.
Yeah. I think my biggest beefs are storytelling vibes. Telling is not showing, and there was so much telling. There was so much telling. Like there was like three openings to the movie in there. I wouldn't have mind seeing everything. I feel like there was like a rejection of the traditional way that Marvel origin superhero movies go, and they went so far to not be everything chronologically in order that I think the story really suffered for it. And as a result, the opening scene is like 20 minutes of this lecture about like, now, you know, your emotions are a thing and just believe me because I'm a trustworthy source who will later be the villain of this story. I don't know. And I felt overly handled in terms of like, there's something about this cat a billion times. And
I still maintain, and I said this back in Austin when we were sitting around talking about it, that a lot of the things that bother you are perfectly justified, but would not have bothered you nearly as much if you had been given a couple of other really good things.
Correct.
I think you would start to forgive the cat. You would forgive
100%.
Some of the references. A lot of that stuff would just go out of the window if you had had something else. And I'm not even going to try to come up with what that other thing would have been. But I think it just needed that one more moment to kind of push you into, okay, that was pretty awesome. I can forget about all this other stuff that was bothering me.
I will disclaim. Now, I would say in terms of my criticisms, the more legitimate are too much telling, not enough showing. The jokes fell flat because they weren't jokes. They were just references. Not enough of a character arc. I never felt imperiled. The universe was made of rubber. At one point, she just like as an off thing, just destroys a rockola and everybody shrugs like that's just a normal thing. This is the universe we live in. Those are the more legitimate cinematic concerns. Plus, on top of that, and emotionally, maybe this is the one that secretly is driving the others. What a waste of the Skrulls. What a waste of the Skrulls.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a waste of the Skrulls or not. I think that is very much in the eye of the beholder based on what more we learn about the Skrulls in the future and what you expected the Skrulls being a Marvel comic.
Sure.
Thing.
Well, keep in mind that the Skrulls were a very powerful super weapon of storytelling. They were a metaphor for the Red Scare, for the idea that somebody you know and love and go to church with could secretly be a communist, right? That was the power of the Skrulls, is that they could pretend to be humans. And they were, as far as I know, virtually never represented as sympathetic characters outside of like a going against type story here or there, but to make them a sympathetic bad guy. And again, I could even be on board with that if you portrayed them effectively as monsters, but also the Kree were bad guys and you had to know that just by, you know, being told that, because you certainly didn't see the Kree doing things that were terribly dishonorable or horrible. You know, they looked like a team of elite super troopers enforcing some kind of justice. Like, I would have loved a version of that where it's like, get me on board with the Kree, make me horrified to discover who they really are, and then let me side with the Skrulls or whatever. But I just didn't really feel it with it. It didn't get me.
The things that I enjoyed about this were the relationship between Ms. Danvers and her friend when they reunite, and the child who looks up to her. That is when I started on my personal scale. I was like, this movie's fine. Fine is kind of down below average.
So it was somewhere before that, but when it got to Fine.
Most of the movie, I'm like, this is fine. I mean, I enjoyed Captain Marvel. I enjoyed her powers and her battles. I enjoyed the space scenes. I was not necessarily feeling like this was a really compelling story arc. I loved seeing Samuel Jackson. I differed with you on that. I thought every scene with Samuel Jackson was super fun for me. I was not bothered by the cat. Maybe that's why. But it wasn't until we started to get some actual like, oh, this is who she was, and this is where she's going. And I liked the final battle enough that it raised it just to good, like just barely, you know, nose above water to good for me. But, you know, for me, certainly not the best Marvel movie that I've seen. And I'm okay with that because I do think we're going to see a better version of this character for me in Avengers Endgame.
Man, I hope so. And I hope I don't carry the baggage of me being disappointed by this movie going into Endgame. I got to tell you, though, it made me reevaluate a lot of other movies that had, if they had, I'm talking about Marvel movies. There are a lot of Marvel movies that I dinged on because they had flat points or they seemed by the numbers. But even those movies had a antagonist with a story who I was compelled by and interested in, and all of a sudden I'd hate to say it, Tom, but this is bottom 10% of all Marvel movies in my book
for you.
For me. And again, it's just the story structure that it's such a bummer. I don't know.
All right. Let's talk about True Detective episodes 6 and 7 of season 3, where I feel like, okay, the story we've been talking about between you and I on this is basically that we're more interested in Roland and his partner's mystery than we are in the mystery of what happened to the girl. This episode starts to give us a lot more about the girl. We actually see in episode 7, the pink room that she's been talking about. And I don't know about you, but for me, it further solidified that that's not the revelation. Like I felt a little thrill when I'm like, the pink room, that's what she's talking about. But it's not mystical. It's not unexplainable. It's like, kind of see where this is going and why she's messed up. But what I'm more interested in is filling in those pieces of his memory that have been kept from us by the storytelling of him as someone who's losing his memory.
Is the last thing you saw, and forgive me, last week, this is one of the greatest positive testaments I can give to True Detective, is it was very difficult for me to stop. I was ready to just gobble up all the rest of the story, because once we hit that pink room moment, I was in all the way. Did you watch anything after her dad sees the pink room?
Well, I mean, I watched the rest of that episode.
Okay.
If you're asking me what happens after that, I'm going to have a harder time telling you exactly what happens, but yeah.
Because there's a whole episode where much more like there's an implication in that moment where you get, when you see the pink room.
And wait, did you watch episode 8?
I guess I did. I didn't think I did. We talked about it. We tried to coordinate
That's
schedules.
That's the series finale, episode 8. Did they wrap up the story?
Oh, no. No.
Okay, but then you didn't watch episode 8. So what are you trying to tell
me? Sorry. Oh, I guess you're talking about, are we talking about the moment that the dad encountered the pink room at the end of one episode?
Yeah, the dad walks in, the room is pink, and behind him is the security guard that they had been interviewing earlier that day.
Did I finish this thing without you and didn't know it? Because
do you know of an episode called Now Am Found?
That's
episode 8.
I mean, I know I can know of an episode.
Ryan found it so hard not to watch episode 8 that he did.
Wait, that's the last episode?
Yep.
Yeah, it's the final episode.
All right, well then, spoiler alert, it ends with you not feeling like it's over. Wow. Damn it. Okay, regardless. It's great. Cinematography is great. The character work is great. The acting is next level. So good. I loved everything about this. I loved the, now I don't know which parts I can say and not say, outside of to say, sorry, I enjoyed it too much. I thought there was 10 episodes.
Nope. And you only told me you watched 6 and 7. So I stopped.
Okay. Well, I will rewatch episode 8.
We'll rewatch 8. All the stuff that happens in these two episodes is filling in the gaps of mostly that middle period. Right. We get a few things about who planted the bag. Turns out it was the guy who became the security guard at Hoyt. We find out that security guard at Hoyt is definitely involved in Hoyt's personal affairs. And I think the ending is when Hoyt shows up with a couple of black cars in front of their house and calls him and says, I could come in and meet your wife and beautiful two children, or you could come out here. But you definitely want to talk to me because you don't want me going telling the police what you did yesterday, which what they did was they killed the security guard.
Yeah. Okay. No, this is all the thing. I think that I got confused because the pink room thing was at the end of episode six. And then,
I remembered which episode it was at.
Okay.
Okay. So, we good?
Yes. We are still in sync. We're still on the same page. Yeah. Episode six ends with her dad finding the pink room and then on Hoyt's property. Episode seven is the one where it's like they find the dead body. It's clearly a staged suicide, all of that stuff. And that scene with Hoyt, like the terror, when you realize the amount of power that they are up against, this as overstated a bad guy as this crazy powerful people pedophile ring is, and as ham-fisted as it was when they're like, oh, ties into this season of True Detective, throws down a newspaper with Woody Harrelson's photo on it, as ham-fisted all that was, like super chills in that moment when all of a sudden he's got a phone call and he's realizing that he's messing with powers that be. What I loved about that moment was that you got a strong sense of why our main character and Roland in their 70s are still scared to even think or talk about this, to even open that up. And you're waiting to see just how bad the penalties are. I
didn't fall for it, but I still gave a nod to the construction of this episode where they're like, you and I, you know, we got to talk about what we did back then when we reopened the case. And they have the moment where, you know, the dad is now dead. And they're like, we did that. We drove him to that. And I was like, you're definitely trying to make me think that that's what you were feeling guilty about. And I'm pretty sure another shoe's going to drop. And of course it does.
Right.
By being the security guard getting killed. But the implication of that is it's what stops him from continuing in his career. Because we get that moment where they say, like, well, you know, I'm surprised you never reopened this case later on. And he's like, yeah. And, you know, he's real vague. And you can't tell if he just doesn't remember or if he remembers all too well. But I feel like we're going to see that in the next episode.
Oh, my God. You have no idea the relief I'm feeling knowing that.
I'm sure.
Because I was just thinking, like, wait, if that's the last episode, then I'm upset at this season.
The end of episode seven is not a good enough end.
Although it did get close enough. What's funny is for that brief moment that I thought that I was hearing that you were correct and that I had seen the whole thing. It occurred to me that we have gotten the bulk of the answers that we want to get. We do know what the bad guy is. We do know what happened to the kids. We do know how horrible it is and why they don't want to talk about it. Like, now we're just waiting for closure at this point going into season
closure,
eight.
Closure and the final missing pieces of Roland's story, right? His like what he did in response is the last thing, which makes sense. That's what our last episode's going to be about. And the mystery was never about what happened to the kids. The mystery has always been, what did he do? And that's what I'm very excited to find out.
And like, even now, like, you know, in a horrific version where this was the last episode, I feel like we got close enough that like, yeah, I think he would feel pretty terrible for murdering that dude. Although technically self-defense, but also technically they took him to a barn and
also technically like violated his civil rights. And, yeah.
But now, what do you think inspired in the security guard guy that level of commitment? I guess just a is it a fear of Hoyt or is it a devotion to him?
I think it's pretty complex, right? Part of it is money and status, right? When he was a highway patrolman, you know, he's like, yeah, I don't miss hemorrhoids and $15,000 a year. So part of it is like, this guy saved me. He gave me a well-paying career. There's also the implication that the dad was gay and ashamed of it, right? Because we see the pamphlet about curing yourself of homosexuality. And there's the very strong implication that the security guard is also gay, because Mahershala says, like, yeah, I don't eat donuts. And he says, yeah, I can tell, you know, and they linger on that shot just enough to make you go, all right, is he also part of this? And maybe there's, especially from that time period, some shielding to say, like, you can have your lifestyle and we'll shield you from those who would judge you and drive you crazy like Tom.
That's like, interesting. Like, I didn't pick up on that at that moment, although I could see how that could be implied, especially at a time when it was more important to speak in code and code. Subtle things went a long way. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So we still don't know what's the main character's name? I want to say Wayne. Wayne. Wayne's wife. We still haven't seen her pass. We still don't know how she dies, right?
Right. I think that's the other thing that we might see come into play. It might happen in they're sort of implying that she just died, you know, because they were getting old and she just happened to go first. And I pretty sure that's not the way.
Well, and by the way, they've done a good job of training us to say there's something extraordinary about this case and the number of people who, you know, die who are looking into it. I did enjoy, I don't know if subtlety is the right word, but all the things that weren't said when Wayne figures out that his son is having an affair with that journalist, and that's why, and that she pursued this specifically to get access to Wayne for this interview, and this weird transactional, everything just sort of by implication, and him saying, like, you know, hey man, if it makes you feel better, at a time I was a fairly passable investigator, you know, so it's not the craziest thing for me to figure this out.
If I can remember what I ate for lunch, you know, that's a big achievement. But detecting things, I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah. Right. I really enjoyed that scene, and it felt very sincere. I also
the other thing I was going to ask about was, do we know? Are we going to get a resolution to his daughter's story? Because really all we've seen is the daughter very young, or she doesn't want to talk to you anymore. And we get our first scene of her in the reinvestigation period where she's on great terms with her dad. She's like, yeah, I don't want to go either, but you know, it's a big step, so I have to. Thanks for driving me, Dad. Now come on, help me move in. Like it's all, there's nothing bad between those two. So whatever goes wrong between them is yet to happen as well.
Yeah. In fact, I guess I hadn't realized how old the daughter was in that reinvestigation period, roughly 1990, I guess, because it almost thought like that hit me hard. And I was like, wait, are they going? Is there another middle ground slightly after the reinvestigation period? But I guess that must have been the same time.
Yeah. Here's another thing I just discovered looking at IMDb to make sure I was getting the names of the characters right myself. Do you recognize Edward Hoyt's voice on the phone?
Uh-oh, no.
Because it's Michael Rooker.
Is it really? Oh, that's amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so that makes me even more excited to watch this last episode.
Hells yeah.
All right. Anything else about True Detective 6 and 7? Now that we realize we really have only watched 6 and 7. Sorry. Well,
and this is an artifact of anti-spoiler culture, is that like the last thing I want to do, like all of a sudden I realized, oh shoot, are my hands tied? I can't talk about it, but I'm glad.
Well, and it's all my fault because I mistakenly said the pink room scene came at the end of 7. And I just didn't know what I was talking about. It comes at the end of 6. I remembered it being the end of an episode.
Right. Well, and it was, in terms of mystery solving, the most important ending. So, of course, you would assume it would be the most recent one. But, dude, it's great. It's as good, possibly.
Do we say possibly better than season 1?
I don't know if it's better than season 1 yet. Oh, let's hold off and see how they wrap it up.
Okay.
It could end up that way, though.
Yeah.
Because the thing about season 1 is they gave you a lot of mystical yellow guy stuff. And in the end, that was fun. But what they gave you in season two was a lot of like, no, this is real world, like abhorrent stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I missed kind of the mystical weird stuff from the first one. This one seems to be striking the balance between them. Like,
yeah,
we're going to give you implications that maybe it's mystical with some weird dolls and stuff. But it turns out it's just going to be real life abhorrent stuff, which I think is a more compelling story.
Gambling man in the chat is saying that the daughter getting dropped off at college was definitely indeed another timeline.
I guess it has to be because she is younger in most of that timeline.
Yeah, they're both kids because remember they were sleeping in the back of the car and the mom was freaked out and had to go check on them.
But honestly, I mean, that doesn't really change anything for me. It's more of a, well, obviously they had a good relationship, so we're going to find out why that soured.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just glad that it wasn't crazy in that moment. So here, if there's one superpower, like season one had, of course, great acting and all that stuff. But you know, if you're going to point to a amazing piece of cinematography, you would point to that unbroken shot that they did in season one. In season three, every scene with Roland and Wayne in their 70s. Is electric. I believe that are old as hell. I believe it.
The table where they're investigating and she's like, I can't believe you guys are still cops at your age. And they're like, yeah, well, we just, you know, it's all we know. So that's what we do. And then he's like, I got to pick her up. And he's like, no, man, you're having a moment. Chill.
I believed all of that. Oh, it was so good.
Yeah. So good. All right, let's move on then, shall we, to The Office UK, episode 2 of season 1. By the way, we got an email from Matt in Leeds, UK, who says, as a UK resident, I had a similar reaction to Brian when the US Office came out. It felt like a bad copy of a series I didn't think needed an Americanized version. However, after it ran out of UK source material, the US Office came into its own and surpassed the UK version, becoming one of my favorite series of all times. Without the success of the US Office, I doubt Parks and Rec would have been made, which is also one of my all-time favorites. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, legit point. Also, I think I'm getting past it. It's really hard to say because I keep translating all the characters into their U.S. counterparts, and I keep discounting. Again, at the time, this was all revolutionary storytelling, and the story beats were not familiar, and seeing, you know, what you would expect to be the main character acting so preposterously was novel. But it takes me a while to give up thinking how much better our Dwight is than theirs and how much better Jim is than Tim and so on. But near the end, I feel like I was getting past it. It is interesting. Two main things. One, man, oh man, did they curse a lot on British television? And they got there's some dark graphic imagery, or I don't know about dark, but there's some graphic sexual imagery described casually, which is not something that I associate with The Office.
Yeah, the actual description where they're like, oh no, it is not. She's like, oh, I thought it was one guy doing this, and he's like, oh no, it's just two guys doing that. And I'm like, wow, they just went out and said all of that. Right. Cool. All right.
And then also, you know, their version of Michael Scott, I still haven't learned the other guy's name. What is it? David Brent?
Yes, David, you have learned his name. Look at you.
David Brent leans into some different territory, whereas our Michael Scott pretty much exclusively relied on 5 to 10-year-old, you know, just barely out of their prime, like, now your mom's saying it, so it's not cool stuff. David Brent goes into some different, darker territory that he just drops here or there. And you don't get the discomfort with himself that you do from Michael Scott. You could tell that everything Michael Scott does is from a terror that he's secretly not as cool as he wants to be. Whereas David Brent, I think he's totally comfortable with who he is and just
he
genuinely doesn't
thinks
care.
He is the coolest guy in The Office.
And
sure.
and in so, maybe he is. Oh, the other thing I noticed is, man, oh man, so many of these British references. Like, I can only tell from the comedy beat timing that I'm like, oh, I assume that was a joke, that fourth name that he said, because I guess it doesn't belong with the other three.
Well, I eat regularly at a British pub, Brian. So of course, I never miss any of those references myself.
Oh, did you catch all those?
Yeah, I can't remember any of them right now, but I'm sure.
You're sure you caught all of them?
Every single one of them.
All right.
Absolutely. There are definitely some, all kidding aside, like there are definitely some moments where I'm like, okay, I don't know who that is, but I get it. I can imagine who that would have been that I knew that would have made that funny or whatever. That doesn't really get in the way for me though, because I think the most fascinating observation you had was that difference between Ricky Gervais and Steve Carell. If you want to point to one thing that is entirely different, between these two, and it doesn't depend on which one you saw first, which one you're going to like, is that Ricky Gervais's David Brent is an entirely different character than Steve Carell's Michael Scott. And I think you nailed it into why that is, because Ricky Gervais wants to show like the ridiculousness of a certain type of person. Whereas I think Steve Carell is just trying to play an insecure manager. And when I say that, I don't mean like it's an easier part for Steve Carell. He's just playing a different character. Whereas I think Ricky Gervais is trying to make a commentary on a certain type of person with David Brent, who is totally lacking self-awareness.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see at what point I fall in love with David Brent, because I'm sure it'll happen. But mm-hmm. for now, he lacks the immediate insecurity that made me feel like I had Michael Scott's number within 10 minutes of the opening of the very first episode.
Right.
And I'm betting there'll be some other deeper insecurity that is revealed, because it sounds like there are other structures that are the same, his unwarranted affection for the on the road sales guy, who I think is only mentioned by name in the second episode here. But as an intellectual exercise, I'm enjoying it. I'm excited to reach that visceral moment where I stop translating everything and enjoy it just for what it is.
Yeah, I think they've done a very good job of showing Jennifer not really respecting David in a way that is, I assume, going to lead to the twist that we got in The Office US, right? And that I'm buying that Jennifer doesn't like David, but tolerates David because she has to right now. I think that's sold. Thought it was interesting too. And I don't remember if the US version did this or not, but Donna, was, you know, someone that is just, you know, a friend of David's daughter that he's letting shadow him. And she is a vehicle for showing off sexism in the workplace.
But also
circa 2001.
She's the eyes through which we see The Office for the first time. He's taking her on a tour. There was nothing like that in the U.S. version of The Office.
There wasn't. Okay. I couldn't remember if there was. So I wasn't certain if I'd just forgotten it. But I thought that was a really cool vehicle for touring us around, because suddenly, and maybe this is on purpose, but Gareth and is it Dawn, the receptionist? You know, their relationship in the first episode is the typical, he's got a crush on her. She kind of thinks he's cute, but she's got a boyfriend, right? In this episode, through Donna's eyes, they look like a couple, right? Like,
right.
You know, he's playing with her hair and they're just like, you know, flirty, joking around all the time. And we never see the boyfriend.
There's no will they, won't they. I mean, it's very clearly Tim is if he hasn't already spent time with her, is about to.
Yeah. And I don't think that's what we're set up for next, but who knows?
Yeah. Have you already seen the UK Office?
I have. I've watched it all the way through, and I don't remember all the twists and turns about it. So I'm sort of enjoying it for the first time again.
Right on.
And I must have been drinking heavily when I watched it the first time, too.
Too much TMI.
Hey, everybody. That is it for this edition of Spoiler in Time. Thanks for supporting us at patreon.com/cordkillers and allowing us to be able to do this every week. We will be back next week with the third episode of The Office, the finale of True Detective, and more. Talk to you then.
Bob hopes you have enjoyed this program.